Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. It's a good day for me. I defended my PhD yesterday, finishing a sort of five-year ordeal, and a very productive and entertaining one in many ways. And so I'm feeling pretty good today, and I'm very happy with this conversation today, because we'll be talking with my friend fellow wire journalist, trench warrior, Steve Silberman, who also has just recently completed a five-year, undoubtedly somewhat grueling task, which is writing what is undoubtedly the best book about autism that we have now, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, which is a long but very well, like my dissertation, which was everyone commented on during the defense, was long. But they also said it was well written, and I can say the same thing for Steve's book, which is long but needs to be, because it's a very complex and fascinating story with tons of colorful characters that Steve brings to life with remarkable flair. I think I first started really thinking about autism when I read a book in the mid-90s by the science fiction writer Greg Egan. The book is called Distress. And the main character in it is a kind of sort of down on his luck science journalist. And early on, there's just one of the sort of brief episodes in the book. He goes and he talks to some autistic activists, and these people are calling for are extremely critical of normals. And believe that autism is actually represents a kind of evolution of human capacities that allowing us to step beyond the kind of mammalian social programming that keeps human beings so benighted. And so it was this radical sense of autism as a kind of like a black power movement. And it really struck me, like it really, it's the most memorable thing. It's a great book, but it was, in some ways it stayed with me the most, because it asked this fundamental question about who gets to say what normal humans are, who gets to say what's a disease or a even a, you know, a negative syndrome, and what is a different way of being in the world. And it very much goes to the heart of this podcast, thinking about cultures of consciousness, a diverse world of cultures of consciousness, including some that have you know, genetic and very deep behavioral elements that may be that can be very difficult for people to deal with, but open up other realms and other possibilities. And so for me, thinking about autism, it's no accident that I read about it in a science fiction book, because it's also sort of thinking about, well, science fiction. Science fiction is part of the story. Fandom is part of the story. What we once called technoculture, at least in the 90s, when it was much more focused, and you could sort of see the way that hacker culture and technology enthusiasm and alternative cultures and the underground all kind of created this very rich world online, and you know, moving into the, you know, expanding internet age, that autism and questions of autism, and indeed meeting autistic people, being with autistic people, or on the spectrum, as we say, you know, high functioning people, was common, you know, part of my life, and so. And continues to be in many ways. And so I'm incredibly happy that Steve has finally completed his epic journey in writing Neurotribes and really uncovering a lot of new material. That's what's cool. It's not simply the kind of usual pop science book where, you know, that you go talk to a bunch of experts and then you sort of translate it in terms that people can, more ordinary readers can understand. Steve did a lot of primary research. He discovered some really important connections in the story. And he also lays out a story that's valuable, not simply for the light that it sheds on autism, on parents, on kids, on the struggles, on the brilliant dimensions of the phenomena. But also it's a story about science and how it's a very 21st century, though most of it takes place in the 20th century. It's a very 21st century because it really shows the complicated ways that science, psychology, the media, people's careers, language, all sort of interact in very complicated ways in order to sort of map the ongoing relationship we have with the very category, with the idea of autism. We'll be getting to a lot of those questions, but just to kind of give it one, to clarify one little bit, there is just how if one was not really paying that much attention, you're just sort of picking up language from around your world. You might at some point have picked up the notion of referring to someone as autistic, but also someone as having Asperger's or an Aspie or Asperger's syndrome. Well, what's the difference? Who gets to say what that's about? And then the phrase "on the spectrum" emerges, and all of these terms, they float around. They're used in technical ways. They allow some individuals access to services. They prevent other people from having access to services, and at the same time, they create this ongoing interface with the world of the people that we encounter. And it's an incredibly great story, not just about autism, but about how science works in society, in history, between different disciplines, with the internet, with parents groups, with pop culture, fan culture, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm very happy. It looks like the book's getting a lot of attention. I'm really happy about that, and happy to have Steve on the show. Steve, congratulations, and thanks for being on Expanding Mind.
Hey, Eric, congratulations to you on finishing your PhD. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I gotta shape it into a. It's not quite a book, It's sort of like multiple levels of things, and I gotta tease it out. And I'm not sure what I'm gonna do with it yet. But it's close.
What's it about, if I may ask?
What's that?
What's it about, if I may?
Oh,
ask?
Yeah. No, it's called High Weirdness, Visionary Experience in the 70s Counterculture. So it's about some of our old friends like Robert Anton Wilson and Terrence McKenna and Philip K. Dick, and how people negotiate extraordinary visionary experience in a very weird a period of technological and cultural change.
That's great.
Yeah. So it's another kind of neurotribe book in a way. And I want to talk about that idea later in the program. But, again, really, really wonderful job. It's a great read, and it does a lot. And I'm sure it'll make a big difference to a lot of people's lives, which is not something that a lot of writers can always say, at least in such a direct sense. I mean, though it's probably a little bit of a boring way to launch into it, I would love to, hear again your story of how you got hooked into this. I mean, I think it's an interesting question where you were as a writer, as a journalist, when you first started to cotton on to the idea that there's a much, much deeper story here than what we were getting at the time, and how you decided to make it such a your life's work for the last half decade.
Well, in the year 2000, I was on a cruise ship in Alaska with more than 100 computer programmers, and sort of the star of the cruise was a guy who invented one of the first open source programming languages, which is called Perl, and without which websites like Amazon and Craigslist and the Internet Movie Database would not have been possible. In fact, Perl hackers call it the duct tape of the Internet. So a very useful invention. And towards the end of the cruise, when we were pulling back into Vancouver, I asked this guy if I could interview him at home. And he said, yeah, sure, I should tell you, I have an autistic daughter. And his remark registered, but I didn't know that much about autism at the time, like most people. Like most people, I believed that it was a very, very rare neurological condition, that the chances of running into someone with autism were very slight. So it didn't really make a huge impression on me. Although when I went to interview him at home, even though his daughter turned out not to be there after all, I did notice that he had customized his environment in interesting ways that were suited for someone with a very sensitive neurology. So he had taken the buzzer out of his clothes dryer and replaced it with a little light bulb that would light up at the end of the cycle instead of this jarring bzzz. So I noticed that he was using his technological skills to customize the sensory environment of his house in an interesting way. But that seemed all par for the course for someone who had, you know, invented this extremely versatile and useful programming language. And he not only invented Perl, but he invented, in a sense, the Perl community, in which you're not judged on the basis of, you know, whether or not you're a star or you have a lot of charisma or whatever. You're just judged on the basis of, is the stuff that you do useful or not to the whole community? And so it's a very, you know, so-called flat, egalitarian community. And I thought that was interesting. So anyway, so I moved on to my next Wired story, which was profiling an entrepreneur couple in Silicon Valley. And they came from a very technologically adept family. In fact, the patriarch of the family had built the first computer in Israel back in the day. So I asked the sister-in-law, this woman I was writing about, if I could come visit her at home. And she said, yeah, sure, I should tell you, we have an autistic daughter. And I thought, God, that's an odd synchronicity, you know, like two children and, in fact, girls, which turned out to be interesting in and of itself, because autism among girls is considered rarer than among boys, although I think we should interrogate that notion. But anyway, so I thought, God, that's odd. So the next day I was sitting in the Reverie Cafe in San Francisco, which you probably know well, and I was talking with a friend of mine, and I told them that story about this odd synchronicity, and a woman at the next table suddenly blurted out, oh my God, do you realize what's happening? And I said, what? And she said, I'm a special education teacher in Silicon Valley. There's an epidemic of autism in Silicon Valley. Something terrible is happening to our children. So I got like a chill, and I got, you know, this, you know, the feeling of the uncanny. And, you know, and when I get the feeling of the uncanny, unless I'm, you know, at a concert or something, it makes me want to go look into it and do some reporting. So I ended up writing a story in 2001 called The Geek Syndrome, which was about autism in Silicon Valley and one plausible hypothesis to explain the reason why this woman believed there was an epidemic. And what was certainly inarguably true was that the estimates of autism prevalence were soaring. And they seemed to be soaring higher in Silicon Valley than other places. So the hypothesis that I explored in The Geek Syndrome was developed by really a guy named Simon Baron Cohen in England, who is, in fact, Sacha Baron Cohen's cousin, I believe. The guy who told me about it was a UCLA geneticist with a kid on the spectrum named Dan Geschwind. And that hypothesis is called assortative mating. And what that is basically two people with autistic traits end up in Silicon Valley where there are social possibilities for people on the spectrum that had never before existed in history, because people are communicating with one another through screens rather than through face-to-face interaction, which, as you know, many autistic people find very challenging. So, you know, that was a very interesting hypothesis, and I explored it in the piece. And I ended up, you know, getting interested not just in autism, but in the families that I wrote about. And what happened was that I got more email about that article. And by the way, I have to say the article had this sort of bad luck of coming out, you know, it was like the week of 9/11 or something like that. So the whole world was completely freaked out about 9/11, and it was originally supposed to be the cover story. It ended up getting thrown in the back of the magazine. But what happened was I got more email about that article than any other article I'd ever written for Wired. And that email came from the families of autistic people, from people who remembered relatives from their past who were probably autistic, from autistic people themselves who, you know, read my article and then, you know, perhaps took an online test developed by Simon Baron Cohen and decided that maybe they should get evaluated for autism. So, you know, I got letters. And what I noticed was, even though the world was having a very rancorous argument about vaccines when my article came out, that as time went on, even families who were convinced that their children had been made autistic by a vaccine, they were no longer obsessing about the causes of autism like they were at the beginning when their child was first diagnosed. What they were concerned about instead was the fact that once their children graduated from high school, they would so-called age out of services. And families were basically left to fend for themselves, and there was like no transitional programs for adults or for even for teenagers who were, you know, if they were able to enter the job market, there was nothing to help them. And, you know, basically, even just to get a kid a diagnosis, you'd have to sign up on a mailing list, and it might be 6 months. And because there was a belief that if you didn't start doing early interventions, you'd so-called miss the window, you know, when the brain was plastic enough to be able to rewire itself in response to the interaction or to the interventions. So parents were like in a continuous state of scarcity of necessary services, and that was a much more pressing issue than arguing with Jenny McCarthy about whether or not vaccines cause autism.
Well, yeah, and this is a great point, yeah. Because this is something this is one of the goals of your story, is to really shift, you know, to encourage the continued shift away from difficult to support scientifically question of vaccines. It's a very complicated issue for a lot of people, but the whole argument about vaccines causing autism, but even more important than that particular debate, which is important to go over absolutely in this case, just the whole focus on cause, on looking at this as some kind of, you know, something that's potentially curable rather than something that over time can be managed in different ways. And that shifts the conversation to support services, to educational means, towards creating new kinds of spaces and environments, to even changing social mores so that neurotypicals become more used to dealing with certain aspects of spectrum behavior and being like, okay, well, that's just another difference that we get to deal with in this world of differences that we now live in. How is that going? Like, how much are people still, either whether it's specifically holding on to the vaccine causing autism story, or just more generally holding on to the idea that this is it's because of the difficult parts of the syndrome, or whatever you want to call it, and how, you know, devastating it can be on people's lives and families' lives. How much are people holding on to it as something that can be cured, that needs this sort of, you know, fight kind of logic, rather than moving into a place where we come to accept that this is part of human diversity and something that needs to be worked with rather than stamped out?
Well, here's the thing. I want to say up front, by the way, you know, there's a tendency amongst, shall we say, you know, San Francisco liberal intelligentsia or whatever, to stereotype anti-vaccine parents as kind of low information, you know, people, haven't they seen the studies? Don't they realize it's been debunked? Actually, quite the opposite is true. Many anti-vaccine parents are extremely sophisticated and are more familiar with the state of the art of autism research than people outside the community. And, you know, it is not a ridiculous idea, the notion that Big Pharma could be, you know, basically promulgating this vast conspiracy, because they've done it before, with particularly with a drug called Vioxx, which was a heart drug that literally killed hundreds or thousands, I forget which, of people before it was taken off the market and Big Pharma successfully covered it up. So, you know, is that a plausible scenario that there's some vast cover-up of global epidemic of vaccine injury? Well, it is a plausible scenario, but it's not what happened in this case, I believe, and I say that from a fairly informed perspective, since I've been devoting 80 hours a week of my life to it for the last 5 years at the very least. And I was actually working on ideas about the book for years before that. But so in other words, I don't dismiss the concerns of those parents. I think they're very real concerns. But I also don't think that's what happened. And in fact, I think that even parents who are convinced that their child was rendered autistic by a vaccine, they need to know about the sweeping changes in the diagnosis that I write about, because – Even if vaccines, let me play devil's advocate to myself and say that even if vaccines do affect some small number of susceptible children, that is a thin layer on top of a gigantic iceberg of new diagnoses caused by the historical dynamics that I write about in this book. So even anti-vaccine parents could learn very valuable information, as well as clinicians, because we've really, you know, even though the anti-vaccine hypothesis has been widely discredited and debunked, we still behave at a federal level in terms of the research as if something like it is true. Mm. We continue to treat autism as a historical aberration that is unique to the modern world. You know, so if it's not vaccines, it's something. It's GMOs, right, says Neil Young, you know, on his new album. He says pesticides. You know, he has a new album called The Monsanto Years. Well, I'm no fan of Monsanto. I think they're disgusting. But pesticides are not going to render half of all children autistic by 2025, as says the completely bogus MIT scientist who Neil is getting that idea from. So we need to take autism seriously, which doesn't mean throwing another, you know, $100 million at trying to stamp out autism or flush it out of the gene pool or something with selective abortion. We need to start taking care of autistic people and their families, and that's when we'll be really taking autism seriously, when we recognize it like schizophrenic people or homosexual people or left-handed people or people with chronic depression. They're not going to go away, and we're not going to figure out some way to make it obsolete, basically. And we have to ask ourselves, what would happen to society if we got rid of, say, all the people with chronic depression, which includes many of the most creative people in the world, or all the people with schizophrenic traits, which includes many of the most creative people in the world, or all the people with autistic traits who have been quietly assisting the evolution of science, technology, and culture for centuries, as Dr. Hans Asperger knew back in the 1930s.
So, you're bringing up Hans Asperger is really great, because that's a, you know, wonderful statement of the goal and the rational and empathetic, compassionate response to the presence of autistic people in our society and people's families and people's homes and our culture and technology, et cetera, to expand the picture, you know, in a way like the most noble, for me, often the most noble thing about liberal Western society as a kind of political, ethical, legal operation. There's a lot of problems with it. You know, I can take some pretty radical views about some things, but one part of it that I really admire is this somewhat slow moving, often painstaking, often quite difficult, and sometimes even violent struggle to increase to open the room to have more and more flavors accepted of what it is to be not just even really human, because I believe we're beginning to do this more and more with animals and with others, but just all of the variations of being that have to be accepted as part of the world and having their own dignity and their own place to stand or place to be in this sort of manifold, this rainbow of differences that we're accepting. But what's interesting to me also about your book and about your whole approach, which I want to underscore because sometimes it can be sort of missed, is how important historical thinking is to answering this problem. That many times the way people read news, the way people think about science, it's they take it out of history. It's like, oh, look, there's a graph that shows that the rates of autism are increasing dramatically, that means that there's something happening now, rather than going, huh, well, I wonder what the history is of the term autism. How did it start to be used? What's the history of the diagnostic? When did we start to change those things? And even though those moves are crucial, people make them all the time, I think it's important to really underscore how much history can help illuminate the present, and you do this so well in your book in talking about this, the tension between these different models and words of, you know, around autism going on throughout the last, you know, whatever, 70 years, 80 years. And so, you know, I want to hear a little bit about that tension. Like, what is the main dynamic in this history you tell? But I also just want to emphasize how important telling histories as well as telling scientific stories about what's happening now is in terms of wrestling with these things. So let's get into the history a little bit. Like Asperger, Kanner, what was the main tension early on as people began to recognize that there was something specific about autistic children?
Well, I'm so glad you said that, Eric, because check it out. One of the innovations of my book, you could say, is that obviously, you know, Asperger syndrome has been written about endlessly. There are probably thousands of titles, you know, on Amazon about Asperger syndrome. Hans Asperger himself has been mentioned in dozens of books. However, I quickly noticed after reading them all that virtually every description of what he did and his clinic was based on the same two or three wonderful paragraphs written by a cognitive psychologist in England named Uta Frith in the 1980s. So in other words, everybody was sort of cribbing off the same set of cliff notes about Hans Asperger's clinic. So I made it my business. And by the way, they weren't saying much about it. They're mostly talking about, well, you know, they would say that Hans Asperger wrote a paper a year after this guy, Leo Kanner, who is credited as the landmark discoverer of autism. Kanner wrote about 11 child patients. Asperger wrote about 4, allegedly, although that's not true. And so, you know, Asperger's discovery in 1944 is considered a mere footnote to Kanner's discovery in 1943. The fact that they both discovered, you know, this overlapping condition a year apart is generally considered one of the great synchronicities of 20th century medicine. And so anyway, and people say that, well, Asperger wrote about high-functioning kids, quote-unquote, his little professors, whereas Kanner wrote about low-functioning kids. Anyway, all this conventional wisdom that is repeated everywhere, I have to say, unquestioningly, even in, you know, NIH facts, basically, you know, will report that Asperger examined 4 children or something. Anyway, I discovered all of these things were incorrect. The entire timeline of autism's discovery, as it is widely accepted, was incorrect. And that, not only that, if you understood the true timeline of autism's discovery, the reason why the numbers have been going up so much in recent decades is much easier to understand. So here's the situation. You have, you know, in, starting about 15 years ago or so, you have two competing stories in the media. One of them is vaccines cause autism. Big Pharma is promulgating this massive conspiracy on a global scale to cover up an epidemic of vaccine injury. And so what's the other story? The other story is some dude from the CDC, you know, in a suit, saying, well, we think it's broadened diagnostic criteria, but, you know, it's still a mystery, you know. And then on the other hand, you have the mom who is like, I'm fighting to protect my child's brain from Big Pharma, you know. It's like, which is the more intensely involving story? Obviously, it's the mom, you know, this public health bureaucrat mumbling about better case finding and broadened diagnostic criteria. It's not going to cut it, you know, in the media. And people in the media are trained instinctively to give a voice to the underdog when they can. Who's the underdog? Well, it's not Big Pharma, you know, and the CDC. So that is why people like Jenny McCarthy, although she's not quite the underdog either, but that is why the so-called army of mommy warriors raised by people like Jenny McCarthy on the basis of the vaccine causes autism theory, that's why they got so much airtime, because it's a much more intensely involving story than the official story, which was always vague and seemed evasive. Like, one reason why autism parents are attracted to the anti-vaccine community is that the anti-vaccine community tells them, you've been lied to. You haven't been told the whole truth. Well, that turns out to be true. It's just that the people who are doing the lying were not necessarily working for Big Pharma. And so anyway, if you want to know the true history of autism, I can tell you it in about 2 minutes now. Is that okay, Eric?
That sounds great. Then we'll take a break after that.
Okay, cool. Here's what really happened. Even though Leo Kanner is credited as the discoverer of autism and was the world's leading authority on the subject for two or three decades, what really happened was that what we now call the autism spectrum was discovered by Hans Asperger and his colleagues in a clinic at the University of Vienna in the 1930s. And so Asperger examined more than 200 children with widely varying manifestations of autism. So some of the kids were nonverbal and would probably have been unable to survive without constant care. So they were very, very disabled. But he also examined, you know, these kids he called his little professors, who were, you know, very chatty and obsessed with stuff like chemistry and watchmaking, and kind of there was an interesting cluster of science and technical interests that captured their imagination. And they loved science fiction as well. So what happened was, in 1938, the Nazis marched into Vienna and marched into Austria and claimed it as, you know, annexed it for the fatherland. And so the University of Vienna, which had been one of the leading intellectual centers of Europe, the Jewish faculty were expelled, either taken off to concentration camps or to be killed, or many of them actually committed suicide. And they were replaced by bumbling Nazi fanatics. So Asperger's boss, who was this guy named Michael Hamburger, was not a bumbling guy, but he was certainly a fanatic. And he loved Hitler. He wrote about Hitler in kind of a weird way for a medical guy, in that he sort of described Hitler as the savior of, you know, the country, et cetera. And so Asperger had to figure out a way, once the Nazis started exterminating children with inheritable conditions like epilepsy and schizophrenia, and in fact the guy who led that effort was one of Asperger's former colleagues, as I talk about in the book, Asperger had to figure out a way to protect the kids in his clinic. So he only told the Nazis in his first public talk on autism, which was the first public talk on autism in history in 1938, he only told the Nazis about his, quote-unquote, most promising cases. And he said that in the talk. I got a transcript of the talk. And he said, we thought it might be best to talk about the most promising cases. He didn't say, because you guys are all Nazis and you're actually exterminating these children. You know, so he was playing a very dangerous and risky game. And in fact, the Gestapo came to his clinic three times to arrest him. But this guy, Michael Hamburger, liked Asperger and protected him. And he was a very, very powerful Nazi. Well, one of Asperger's colleagues, George Frankel, who was Jewish, left the country. And maybe we should take a break. And I can go on with the story of George Frankel, because it's fascinating.
No, this is great. Your timing is impeccable. It was 2 minutes. And so, yeah, we're going to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking with Steve Silberman about his book, Neurotribes, and we'll be right back. Just going to have a little musical interlude for this break. We didn't have any promos ready at the moment, but so we got to enjoy Mark Pilkington's theme music once again in its full splendor. So now we can go back with the story story, Steve. Yeah, let's carry forward with the now that with the evil Nazis have entered and left the tale, let's follow to America. Hello?
1938 is has discovered the autism spectrum and only told the Nazis about his quote unquote most promising cases that he termed his little professors. And he wasn't just lying to the Nazis and condescending to the kids with that nickname, because he actually saw the kids as little experts on their own condition. And so one of the innovative things about Asperger's Clinic was that he actually asked the kids about how they felt about various approaches to what they were doing. And so the kids informed Asperger's pedagogical style, which is really amazing. As, you know, when you write a book, there are some people that you'd love to sit down and have tea with or something. And Asperger was definitely one of those people in this book. Another really cool, I think, suggestion that he made to try to save his kids from the Nazis was he told the Nazis that the kids would make good code breakers for the Third Reich because of the way their minds worked. Well, if you think about it, who were the greatest code breakers of World War II? Well, it wasn't the Nazis, it turned out. It was the Allies, with people like Alan Turing and Bletchley Park. Is it a shock that, you know, many people believe that Alan Turing was on the spectrum somewhere? I mean, he was certainly gay, but many people also believe that Alan Turing at least had autistic traits. And so it turns out that, you know, if there was one group of, or one side of the war that reaped the benefits of Asperger's suggestion, it was the Allies rather than the Nazis. Thank God. So that's kind of an interesting little side note to history, you know. But so what happened in 1938, besides the fact that the Nazis started exterminating children like the children in Asperger's Clinic, is that Jews were put in a very perilous position. And the German propaganda machine started pumping out cartoons in which not only disabled people but Jews were sort of sucking the lifeblood of the fatherland and everything. So basically, Asperger's Jewish colleagues had to split or they would have ended up in the ovens. And so one of his Jewish colleagues was his chief diagnostician, this guy named George Frankel, who actually worked with the children to figure out methods of education that would be appropriate for them. And so George Frankel leaves. How does he get out and where does he go? Well, he gets out of Vienna with the help of an American child psychiatrist named Leo Kanner. And so, by the way, it looks like Kanner, but it's actually pronounced Connor. And one of the most hilarious footnotes to this grand epic tragedy is that when Kanner first came to America, he worked in a mental asylum in the Midwest, and there was a group of Mennonites with schizophrenia, and they called him Father O'Connor, even though he was very Jewish. But anyway, so Connor hired George Frankel to run a children's clinic that was very much like Asperger's Clinic in many ways. It was a very progressive place. And historians have puzzled, you know, kind of the I buried Paul dilemma of autism is that Leo Kanner's landmark paper published in 1943 begins, since 1938, a number of children have come to our attention, dot, dot, dot. Well, you know, there was just a paper published recently by anti-vaccine people called The Mystery of 1938. What happened in 1938? Well, the obvious answer is that Connor's first autistic patient, a guy named Donald Triplett, came to the office. So that's the easy answer. But the not-so-easy answer, which I figured out for my book and thus solving, I have to say, a mystery of long standing in 20th century medicine, is that George Frankel was hired by Connor to run the so-called child study home. So when Donald Triplett arrived in Connor's office, Connor was a smart guy with a deep knowledge of child psychiatry, but what Cunard did was to send this guy, Donald T., to George Frankel over at the Child Study Home. And if you think about it, George Frankel, by that point, had worked with Asperger and with Asperger's colleagues in Vienna for 11 years, had seen, you know, dozens and dozens of autistic children by that point. And so George Frankel knew exactly what he was seeing. And in fact, George Frankel diagnosed Connor's first three autistic patients. And so the mystery of 1938, which I solve in my book, is that not only did Donald Triplett arrive to be evaluated, but George Frankel arrived to do the evaluation. And so the notes in Connor's landmark 1943 paper of clinical observation of the first three patients were, in fact, written by George Frankel and also another woman named Eustacia Cutler. And somehow everyone has overlooked the fact that George Frankel gets a name check in Connor's paper. No one noticed that the same name pops up in both the records of Asperger's Clinic and Connor's landmark paper. And once I figured it out, I actually had to, you know, triple check, because it's like, well, maybe George Frankel is a common name. Actually, it is a common name. And in fact, there was a psychologist named George Frankel who was not this guy, you know, but who was famous a little bit later in the 20th century. So, you know, I had to weed out the possibility that it was some other dude named George Frankel. Yeah. But I
What's great about this discovery, too, is just it or the way that it draws a link between Connor and Asperger, because they end up presenting such different models of what we now would recognize as positions on the spectrum, if you will. And while I would love to go more, and now we have about, you know, 10-15 minutes left, and I just encourage people to go in and dive in and read this history. But what I'd like to ask a more general question, kind of based on that tension, is, and we could think of it in more contemporary terms, in terms of the DSM going from having a distinct category of Asperger's syndrome versus as opposed to autism, and now a broadening of the term to include the autistic spectrum. I really think this is a fascinating and really important idea, not just in terms of how we think about autism, but how we think about humans, human behavior, categorizing things in general. In general, we, you know, our whole society still holds on to this kind of black and white: you are, you're not. Are you male or you're female, or you're this or you're that? And that black and white thinking is, like, you know, through medicine, through science, through legal, you know, mechanisms, through how we think about people in our lives, et cetera, et cetera. It's very easy for humans to think that way. It's hard for humans to think about spectra. It's hard for us to think about things that are gradations. There's shades of gray. There's shades of purple. There's shades of all the rainbow colors almost everywhere we look. And so I would love to have you reflect a little bit about the tension, which must happen also inside of autistic communities, or inside, you know, of people who are on the spectrum, because there is a distinction, or I should say rather, there's a whole set of distinctions between people who are, let's call them, high functioning, or there's a number of words people have called, or Asperger's, or having autistic tendencies, from people who have a great deal of difficulty interacting with human society at all, or even harming themselves, or behaving in ways that are destructive themselves. That's, you know, that's low functioning, or whatever you want to call it exactly. Now we're recognizing there's a spectrum, but there's still this extraordinary tension where we're talking about a profound syndrome that can be very devastating, and very, people who are barely in human society in terms of being able to engage or communicate on one hand, and then other people who are, you know, running companies in Silicon Valley and building devices, and, you know, whether they're nerds or not, or fans or not, they're fully able to make it in humans, you know, our contemporary society. So talk a little bit about that. What's at stake with insisting that that's a spectrum and not something we should or could even break down into high functioning little professors on the one hand, low functioning, you know, semi retarded or semi schizophrenic, or the other terms that have been used historically to characterize these people? What's at stake in insisting on the spectrum?
Well, I actually think that The concept of the spectrum is one of the most subversive ideas that was invented in the 20th century because its implications are really heavy. Like, and in fact, I would say that even some people who think of themselves as, you know, sort of autism advocates or pro-neurodiversity or whatever, like, they can be a little bit in denial about the fact that what we're talking about can be a very highly devastating condition, particularly if the child or the adult does not have adequate forms of support. But we're not just talking about, you know, people say, you know, we're not like taking some Pollyanna view that like, well, you know, oh yes, we're all on the spectrum. Jerry Seinfeld's on the spectrum, you know. He said he was on the spectrum for about 24 hours after he saw the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime on Broadway. But the problem with that is that if Jerry Seinfeld is on the spectrum, then, you know, why do these people need support and resources? He's doing fine, you know, or if Mark Zuckerberg is on the spectrum, then what are we talking about with support and resources? He's a, you know, millionaire. Well, no. You know, most people who have an official diagnosis of autism really struggle in day-to-day life and really need help in school, at work, if they can work, in relationships, in their own lives. So we're not talking about a trivial condition. We're talking about something that is can be profoundly disabling, particularly in the absence of support. But the heaviest idea at the heart of the notion of neurodiversity is that mankind's gifts are inextricable from disability. And that was specifically Asperger's idea, actually, although nobody knew it until I translated, or had translated by German speakers, Asperger's 1938 speech. But it was really Asperger who first realized that the implications of seeing autism as what he and George Frankl called a continuum is that humanity's most highest gifts are inextricable from things that can make daily life almost impossible in the absence of adequate support. And certainly you've written about Philip K. Dick. Am I wrong? Did he not have a lot of schizophrenic traits?
Yeah, I mean, he's a great example of someone who's, and the more you look into his biography, which becomes harder and harder because the exoticism peels away and you realize you're dealing with a guy who's suffering a lot and caused a lot of suffering in ways that were often very unromantic and quite disturbing, that it's so clear that those features are absolutely inextricable from the things that made him a genius and a prophet or whatever you want to call it. And I think that the point you just made is extraordinarily important. And I mean, I remember I've had my own psychological struggles, depression, and, you know, whatever I've had, you don't have to go into it now. But I remember very distinctly when a friend of mine, you know, when I was going off again, or I was trying to pull myself out of some mire, and he was like, look, you know, some of us are just, you know, we're wired in a certain way where we're going to fall into those things. And, you know, there's ways to be, there are better worse ways to deal with it. But you got to recognize that stuff is inextricable from your gifts too. And that really taking that on and, you know, personally, but also then looking at other people and other people's foibles. And I increasingly look at the world that way. So when I know people when something's annoying or really disturbing, or I'm like, well, okay, let's see what is this tied into? Where does it sit in this weave that we're all in? And it's been quite illuminating. And I agree with you. I think it's an incredibly subversive idea.
Yeah, and the other like subversive idea, kind of, you know, embedded in the concept of the spectrum, is that nothing that we call autism is completely absent in so-called neurotypicals. So in other words, as Lorna Wing told me, the spectrum shades imperceptibly into eccentric normality. And what she means by that is there is no bright line between autism and non-autism. And, you know, that can be misused so that Jerry Seinfeld ends up saying that he's on the spectrum, or it can be used in an appropriate way, which is that we as a society start to entertain the possibility that autistic people are full human beings who deserve the same civil rights as anybody else, and that, you know, autism speaks does not need to speak for them, because particularly in the era in which adults are diagnosed, and many of those adults have very clear ideas about what they want their lives to be like and what kinds of access they want to educational resources, et cetera, we should be listening to them instead of treating all autistic people like we treated nonverbal children in the, you know, the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And so really the most subversive notion in my book is that autistic people are full human beings who deserve to be listened to and who deserve to set the parameters of their own lives. Now, obviously, not all autistic people are capable of that, and some of them require, for instance, keyboards to talk, etc., but that's what we should be doing. We should be enhancing communication and listening to autistic people and figuring out what autistic people and their families truly need instead of, you know, sending another $50 million to the Beijing Genomics Institute to find more candidate genes in a list that already includes more than 1,000 candidate genes, and, you know, congratulate ourselves for taking autism seriously, because we're not, actually.
Yeah, and that's the thing I'm going to, because I've known parents of autistic children, and these are, you know, Bay Area people who have good technology jobs, and they're, you know, they have resources, and it's still incredibly difficult. I can only imagine the challenges that people face, even as this dialogue is happening and people and awareness is increasing and educational protocols are changing and there's more, you know, people who are focusing on this as their careers, et cetera, in terms of education and support. Where do you see, where's the action now? What's the kind of a more targeted goal that you see within the community, what people are calling for in terms of the kinds of support people are really crying out for now?
Well, there's a wonderful group called the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network that is demanding a place at the table when federal policy is set for autism, and they're incredibly effective, in part because one of the two founders of ASAN is, you could say that his special autistic interest is public policy. He went on a road trip with his buddies when he was a teenager, and while they all brought along, you know, like Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath, he brought along best oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court to listen to. So his name is Ari Niemann, and he's a character in my book. But ASAN is a wonderful organization that is training the next generation of autism activists who are, many of whom are women, by the way, who are younger and who are in college. They're training them how to stay in college and not freak out from the sudden demands and, you know, from leaving home, because new environments can be very disorienting for autistic people. So they're enabling autistic students to stay in college and then to become very effective public policy activists. And one or two ASAN members have become White House champions for change in recent years. And they are a very wonderful organization who is well worth donating to, I would say, instead of Autism Speaks.
Just a couple minutes left. There's one question I have to ask you. You know, the book is called Neurotribes, and for me, the most revelatory part of it was the access to hear so many voices of people on the spectrum, and particularly the chapter at the end or towards the end where you talk about the growth of autistic culture as a self-conscious place with its own conferences, its own ways of gathering, you know, that's really emerging and emboldened by technology beginning in the mid-90s, not coincidentally at the same time that I read that thing in distress about, you know, activists, autistics, although in more of a sci-fi mode. And to get a flavor for the inside of autistic culture as well as individuals was just, you know, it was a remarkable part of the book. And your sensitivity to tribes, your sensitivity to the way in which people can build cultures, do you see there's any relationship to that in the fact that you're a full-on deadhead and you've written about the Grateful Dead and you're very familiar with cultures of consciousness? Not saying that that the autism had anything directly to say to that, but something about the sensitivity for how people build alternative worlds with the materials they get and whatever. Do you see any connection with that for you?
Eric, I have no idea what you're talking about. No, I'm just kidding. No, you know, the secret truth is that the book that I wrote about the deadhead subculture with David Schenck in the early 1990s called Skeleton Key, and the book that I just wrote in the last 5 years called Neurotribes, there's definitely some kind of subtext that they share. And that is, brilliant outsiders with a handle on some things that the mainstream is absolutely clueless about, building a community using whatever means necessary. And so, I would perhaps only say to you that there is definitely some kind of kindred spirit animating both books.
Wonderful. I'm glad I pried that out of you. Well, you know, your TED talk has gotten, you know, tons of response, and I'm sure you're just beginning a whirlwind of publicity and attention that this book will get. At least I hope that happens, that it deserves to happen. And anything coming up that you want to let people know about or other elements in the debate that you want?
Well, they can go to stevesilberman.com/events. I'm going to be reading twice in New Jersey at the end of October, I believe. There is a big show about books that I'm going to be on pretty soon, but I can't really say what it is. But if you listen to book shows on major public radio networks, you may hear me next week. But so I'm really glad that the book is getting attention. I'm also really glad that autistic people are getting attention because I wrote this book and included their voices. Because for a long time, the whole, autism parents movement and the autistic rights movement, they've been, kind of oddly walled off from each other for some very good set of historical reasons that I explore. But it's time for everybody to start listening to each other and to build a better world for autistic people and their families.
Wonderful. Well, let's end there. Steve, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much, Eric. It was an honor.
Yeah, great. All right. To all you listeners out there, keep your minds open.